Coming up is the program Conversations with Michael Stone and today's guest, Bill Twist.
Bill Twist, welcome back to Conversations.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, there's no moss growing on you, I know that. And wanted to talk a little bit today about your experience of spending a year down in Ecuador and working with President Correa and the new constitution, and a little bit about what's happening in South America. So how was that, spending a year down there?
It was great. I mean, as you know, my wife, Lynn, and I had been involved with a foundation we started there a number of years ago. There was a lot of stuff going on in Ecuador 2008. Both the new government, President Rafael Correa's government, very progressive government, had come in and had an initiative to rewrite the constitution of the country. At the same time, there was a lot of work going on with the indigenous groups that we'd been working with, some fairly major initiatives around economic development for them in the Amazon, ecotourism, an aviation service serving ecotourism. These were economic initiatives that were growing in their area, and it was just a useful time for Lynn and myself both to be there, being business coaches for them with their businesses for the indigenous people.
Were the Achuar or other tribes also?
Primarily the Achuar. The business initiatives were with the Achuar. We were really working with all the other tribes. But the timeliness worked out. The Achuar had just taken over an ecotourism lodge that had been in their territory for 12 years and had been turned over to them to run themselves. It had been run by outsiders in the past. So they were going through this transition of how to figure out how to run an ecotourism project. And it's a major world-class ecotourism project that's won awards all around the world. So
that's the Kapawi Lodge.
You've been there. That's right. And I'm not an ecotourism expert nor a lodge manager, but I have some business background, and Lynn has a wonderful touch for what would appeal to visitors at a lodge. So it was just a great time for us to be there because they had taken on the management of this lodge, and having some outside people who could assist them with the transition was propitious. So we decided to go and spend a year living down there, both to work more closely with the indigenous people, and then, as we said, there was a process of creating a new constitution that had been launched by the Correa government. The work on the constitution, what we really dove into through our foundation there, was the environmental issues and the indigenous rights issues that would be built into the constitution. And our foundation works really closely with the whole range of indigenous movement, all the way from the Amazon, with the bases of people in the Amazon, all the way up through the national indigenous movement. And we were able to play a pretty significant role in supporting the indigenous people to get their agenda heard and included in the Constitution. And we introduced an idea that we'd come across up here from some work that Pachamama Alliance had done in the past, looking at environmental sustainability issues in the developed world. We came across the work of a lawyer named Thomas Lindsay, who's been doing work on rights for nature, creating rights for nature and building that into constitutional structures. And so we took that idea and brought it to Ecuador. We brought Thomas Lindsay down a couple of times, but our foundation really took on the job of coordinating with all of the assembly members in the Constitution, educating them about this idea, showing them what the impacts would be, the idea of nature having fundamental rights, not just being a property interest, but being the subject of constitutional law rather than a property interest being the object of constitutional law, that nature has a fundamental rights-bearing entity like a human being is, and that got built into Ecuador's constitution. It's the first constitution in the world, and I say the first because I think it's a trend that's going to start happening around the world, that Ecuador's constitution is the first constitution in the world to enshrine basic fundamental rights for nature to exist and provide the environmental services that nature provides, not just to humans, but to the whole web of life.
What a huge paradigm shift that is for our cultures.
Yeah, and it's certainly consistent with the discussion around the world that's taking place now around creating a sustainable human presence on the planet, where we honor nature, where we see that that we can't have an economy that supports everyone, we can't have a society that supports people and other living things unless we really honor the basic fundamental rights of nature to exist and provide the web of life that allows all of us to exist. So enshrining that concept into legal structure is, I think, a necessary first step for humans to take to then alter the way we behave and see ourselves interacting with nature and honoring nature.
Now, you were also working on the Plan Verde down there.
Yeah, that's a project we've been working on for a number of years. It's actually developed into a major project that the government of Ecuador has taken on in terms of leaving oil in the ground under Amazonian areas where it's clear there's oil in the ground under the Amazon in Ecuador, but what's on top of the ground in the Amazon in Ecuador is one of the most important biodiverse regions on Earth. It's becoming clearer to people that the oil we've got under the ground is valuable, but also has a lot of costs associated with pulling it out of the ground. Not just the environmental damage that happens when you take it out, but what happens after you take it out, we burn it, so then we put its waste into the atmosphere. So there's clearly a growing movement in the world to recognize that it's not necessarily always a benefit to bring oil out of the ground, and there's a growing movement to recognize that it's more and more important to preserve the Amazon rainforest and the great environmental benefits that it brings to all life. So we had come up with an idea, which was, as you said, called Plan Verde, which was a new way of protecting rainforest lands that are sitting on top of valuable mineral, non-renewable resources like oil. And it was basically creating a dialogue with the international community to have the international community compensate Ecuador in this case, but any country that's got environmental riches like a rainforest, to compensate that country for actually preserving the rainforest, and that compensation would be also compensation for leaving the oil in the ground.
And wasn't there also an aspect of that which was debt relief, which was also part of much of what we started in the first place with USAID and the World Bank and the loans that we made that will never probably be paid back?
Right. One of the mechanisms that was being proposed with Plan Verde was that one way that the international community could compensate Ecuador was through debt forgiveness, either through the multilateral lending agencies, the IMF, the World Bank, or directly bilateral loans from country to country. And that was one of the mechanisms that we had proposed originally when we put what we called Plan Verde together, probably 4 or 5 years ago that we started talking about it. Ecuador has actually taken that project even farther than we had talked about it, and Ecuador has a project now to leave the oil in the ground under one of their biggest oil fields in the whole country. It's called the ITT. It's in the Yasuní National Park. There's nearly a billion barrels of proven reserves, and Ecuador is saying, the government of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, is asking the international community for support to leave that oil in the ground and to protect and put into permanent protection, expanding essentially the protection of the Yasuní National Park into greater protected areas, and asking the international community for compensation to Ecuador. And the basic formula is compensation that equals approximately half of what the value would be to Ecuador if it took that oil out.
How many acres is that?
Well, the actual concession where the oil is only about 200,000 hectares. But the area of Ecuador that Ecuador is saying that if we get this compensation internationally, we will use to protect. They'll protect a wide range of the Amazon, and that's close to 5 or 6 million acres, say 2.5 to 3 million hectares of land.
And a hectare is about 2.5 acres.
Yeah, about 2.5 acres. What Ecuador's done with that now is also they're using this project as a major project as a nation to go to the Climate Change Convention in Copenhagen in December, when we will come up with, hopefully the world will come up with the next version of our climate change laws, supplementing or replacing the Kyoto protocols. And what Ecuador is using is this particular project as a way of getting the developed world to pay for rainforest preservation and leaving minerals in the ground like oil that would create that obviously is a greenhouse gas, can convert into a greenhouse gas. Ecuador is using that project, the ITT project now, as a example to try and negotiate something that would support rainforest preservation in Copenhagen in December.
Now, I'd like to take a little sidestep here. I know you and Lynn went down and visited some of the really bad sites of the spills, the Texaco spill and Chevron and some of the other things around Shell. Can you say a little bit about your experience of the impact of when you saw that and how the people were impacted? I mean, that had to be a really emotional. I want to share that with our listeners about the experience you had there.
Yeah, what you're referring to is the damage, environmental damage from the oil exploitation that took place in Ecuador in the north of the Amazon, starting in the late 60s. And this was oil development that was opened up originally by Texaco, U.S. company Texaco, in the late 60s, early 70s, and continued through the 80s, I think, and around at the end of 1980, Texaco left. The practices that Texaco used in extracting oil from the Amazon in northern Ecuador at that time were practices that were basically get as much oil out as we can as cheaply as possible without concern for the environmental impact. They were practices used at that time that were not used in any other places in the world where there was monitoring going on. So out in the Amazon at that time, the indigenous people, when Texaco went out, the indigenous people didn't speak Spanish. They weren't organized. Ecuador itself had never had oil exploitation going on in its territory, didn't know what the rules were. Texaco basically wrote the rules. The government at the time was susceptible to outside interests, to bribes, to corruption. The rules that got written for how oil development took place were pretty totally just out in the Wild West. Nobody was monitoring it. I want to say, though, also in Texaco's defense, they worked with the Ecuadorian oil company. So Ecuador's national oil company was their partner out there as well. There's a big argument going on now because Chevron bought Texaco. The suit was against Texaco originally. Now the suit is against Chevron. Chevron is arguing that the environmental damage is the result not just of Texaco or Chevron, but of the Ecuadorian oil company, too. And it's clear that some of that is the case, that the Ecuadorian oil company was complicit in the practices out there. So independent of whose practices they were, though, when you see the areas, you go out and there's pits where the waste muds, the waste drillings, were just poured out into the environment. They were put in huge pits. The pits weren't covered. When it rained, the pits would overflow. The oil and residues of the drilling muds and the toxins would go right into the rivers and right into the rivers that people were using for bathing, for cooking. There is still many places where Chevron, Texaco, and even Petro Ecuador claim that they cleaned up, but the cleanup was totally inadequate. There's places where supposedly pits had been cleaned up, but if you dig into the pit just 6 inches down with a stick, it's gooey, tar-like petroleum substance.
How many acres are we talking about here? How big a piece of land?
Well, this is probably 1 million acres that was affected. I think it's that. I mean, I don't know exactly, but I'm just thinking now up in the north, pretty extensive region from Lago Agrio down to Coca and east, And it's 300 or 400,000 hectares, probably for sure. I may even be low on that. But there's hundreds of waste pits where the residue is oozing into the streams. There's lots of documented evidence of people who have suffered certainly major skin diseases, but then also internal cancers, tumors. It's a tragedy. There's obviously a big legal case over it. Chevron's defense is that they're not responsible for all of it, that the state was responsible for parts of it too. Chevron claims that they cleaned it up to what the state of Ecuador required, but it's clear that it was totally inadequate. So whoever is legally responsible is a fine issue that misses the fact that it's just the practices of the state, of the oil company, of the oil industry, and it going out into pristine areas of the Amazon, the practices of the oil industry in the past have been totally inadequate, have just destroyed ecosystems and destroyed many, many, many human lives. So you asked, so what was the impact? It was impactful, it's impactful just thinking about it again.
Well, I'd like to jump, because I want to include what's happening right now in Peru, because that's also Achuar and Shuar territory, and there's a whole different thing going on there with President Garcia.
Right. Just a couple weeks ago, I was talking with people about the indigenous people in Peru for the first time had really become organized. Peru is a huge country compared to Ecuador. Its Amazon region is vast. The indigenous people had never really been well organized protecting their rights. There's been a lot of movement over the last 10 years around the world in recognizing the rights of indigenous people, and it started showing up in Peru. And the indigenous people in the Amazon recognize that they're living in an area that they've protected for years. They're recognizing it as an area that's important, vitally important, not only for themselves, but for the whole world. And they have gotten organized around the rights that they have to protect the environment and their way of life. About a year ago, when Peru signed a free trade agreement with the United States, one provision that the Peruvian Congress gave to their president, much as we used to argue over fast-track authority when we signed trade agreements, that was something that allowed the president to make whatever decrees he needed to make without going back to Congress to get the trade agreements implemented. Garcia asked for that with his Congress, and the Congress gave it to him when he signed the trade agreement with the United States. And he passed immediately, I think, 99 decrees that he said were essential to be able to implement this free trade agreement. And buried in those decrees were 10 anyway, maybe more, but I know 10 specifically, that when outside environmentalists and activists and even people in their own Congress looked at these decrees, they said, well, wait a minute, these violate our own constitution or they violate international law. And they were basically decrees that he wrote that stripped rights for prior consultation, prior consent, ownership, indigenous ownership of land, stripped it from indigenous people. There was one of the decrees basically said that if there's land that's not officially titled, then it reverts to the state. That's totally different than what's been going on throughout Peru in trying to get land titling done for indigenous people, and it's totally counter to what's gone on around the Amazon in titling land for indigenous people. There's a recognition that indigenous people have ancestral land that hasn't been titled, but everybody knows where it is. There was another decree that said that if the land was titled but it wasn't being used, it could come back to the state. Well, Amazonian land isn't used. It's honored. It's given the right to exist. So the indigenous people were justifiably upset about that. The right to have consultation about anything going on in their territory is an international labor law decree, part of international labor law that the Peruvian Constitution honors. And one of the decrees reversed that. And in December, actually, what happened was the Congress of Peru impaneled a special committee and looked into the indigenous people's claims, and in December wrote a report which they was an unofficial report of a committee of the Congress in Peru that basically validated the claims being made by the indigenous people and said that several of these decrees are unconstitutional and need to be reversed or need to be addressed. That was done in December. The government, Alan Garcia's government, somehow stopped that report. It was public, but stopped it from being taken up and looked at by the proper authorities within the Peruvian Congress. So it's been sitting there, not being dealt with. The indigenous people know about it. So in April, they started protesting. And the way they protest is they shut down roads, they shut down production facilities. They did this all nonviolently. But the amazing thing was that it was all around the country. And it was a result of indigenous people really learning what their rights are. But Garcia got very upset with the fact that these demonstrations had spread around the country and were also starting to get a lot of support from academics, intellectuals within Peru. And so these demonstrations started in April. And I had met with people in May talking about this, and there was a sense of great joy and possibility that this indigenous movement was representing a new way of seeing the future, honoring nature, honoring community. This movement was getting so much support within Peruvian society as well. And there was this upswelling of optimism about, wow, Peru is moving, is going to be a leader in this future world. And I don't know if that is what then prompted Garcia. He saw something building that could have caught the imagination of the whole country. What he wanted to do was open these areas up to foreign exploitation. He wants the revenue that he can get from oil and mineral development, timber, and is not concerned with the impact on indigenous people or the impact on the environment.
Right. The comment he made was
pretty strong.
It was something to the effect that these, depending on how you interpret the word, second-class citizens or inhuman people,
right.
40,000, he said it was 40,000 yeah. people, are going to usurp the rights of how many people?
28 million
people.
Right.
Yeah.
I think he said 400,000. And he's talking about the Amazonian people. Yeah, and I know from working with the Amazonian indigenous people in Ecuador, and we work with the Amazonian people in Peru because the Achuar are in Peru as well as in Ecuador. These are not unsophisticated savages. These are very, very grounded, wise, bright people who recognize the value of their culture. They certainly recognize the value of their culture to themselves and their children and future generations, but they recognize the value of their culture to the world, not in an arrogant way, but in just a very solid way that they can see what's going on in the outside world, and they know that they as indigenous people have a way of dealing with each other that's useful and valuable and would be useful and valuable for other people in the world. They also know totally that their relationship with the environment and their relationship and sense of custodianship for the Amazon is something that is essential for the future of the world. So these are not... Garcia's comment was totally
shocking.
Uncalled for and shocking for a world leader, because it's clear that anybody who deals with indigenous people, their leadership, somebody who rises to be a leader of indigenous people, he gets into that position, he or she, because they're chosen to do that. They don't, within their culture, you don't run for election. You get pushed into that position because you're qualified. So the people that end up representing them are not savages. They're people with great wisdom, great sensitivity to human interaction. And if the media in Peru would cover them and cover the speeches and the requests of the indigenous people, I'm sure it would sway public opinion much, much stronger in favor of the indigenous movement.
Well, he probably feels a huge threat because there's a whole movement, and you're talking about, again, the indigenous people's leadership. Let's talk a little bit about Evo Morales and what's happening.
Yeah, it's interesting. The free trade agreement that Peru signed, the U.S. had, that free trade agreement was supposed to be a free trade agreement of the Andean region. It was supposed to be Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia. Both Ecuador and Bolivia pulled out of that. And now I think Colombia signed a separate agreement and Peru signed an agreement. So Evo Morales and Rafael Correa both represent a very progressive, populist kind of leadership that's emerged. Evo Morales being an indigenous person himself, Rafael Correa not being, but coming from a background of actually living with the indigenous communities in Ecuador, speaking the Quechua language. They're both people who have a vision that their country, the purpose of their country, whatever boundary, these arbitrary boundaries that create nation states, that at least all of the resources within those boundaries should be used in a way to benefit all of the people inside those boundaries. Mm-hmm. So both Morales and Correa have done a lot to change the rules under which foreign corporations operate in their countries. And they're not trying to exclude the corporations, but they've changed the rules so that how the benefits are shared. And they both did that sort of unilaterally, canceled contracts, which in the international business community makes a huge stink over that. But these contracts were contracts that were written 30 years ago when the governments had no idea what the contracts really meant.
And what the problems really were.
Yeah. I mean, what the cost of having these contracts fulfilled that weren't going to be included in the contracts. And what really happened was over the last, say, 5 years, commodity prices exploded around the world, really went up. And all these governments noticed, how come we're not making any more money off these contracts? Because the contracts were all written in a way that the upside was taken by the foreign companies. And so Morales canceled the contracts, and Correa canceled the contracts. It was a huge international...
What about Chavez?
Yeah, Chavez did the same thing, although Chavez had... I mean, the oil contracts were mainly his state oil company controlled them for quite a while. But yes, Chavez also. Chavez, Morales, Correa... But also, there's progressive governments now, and Paraguay just elected a progressive, Brazil, much more progressive, Argentina.
I was going to ask you about Argentina and Brazil being the larger populations.
Yeah. You know, they're certainly more Western-oriented than the Andean nations are, or at least the Andean nations of Peru, Ecuador, and Bolivia. But in all of these countries, there's a general movement recognizing that outside influence... Outside imperialism, colonialism has run the agenda in those countries for 400, 500 years now. It's basically meant that those countries were run for the benefit of people far outside the borders of those countries, other than a small elite that had sort of a contract with the colonizers that they were given... They were given enough crumbs that they were happy as long as the rest of the country was turned over to exploitation. That was basically the bargain. And throughout Latin America now, that bargain is being seen as, for what it really was, totally flawed and not in the interests of the people of those countries. And there's a movement now, a growing populist movement, that the purpose of those nation states is to benefit the people in the nation states and the revenues, the resources there to be used and spread as broadly and equitably as possible. And that's what Correa represents, that's what Morales represents, that's what Chavez represents. I mean, I think it's a really positive trend in development, and it's the way we're going to have to go over the next 50 years, 40 years, 30 years to have a sustainable world. We're going to have to incorporate that kind of thinking into the way the industrialized world operates as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the economics. That's an area you have a lot of experience and you know a lot of new and innovative ways that are being proposed, like Thomas Lindsay's thoughts too, but more on the financial monetary side. What's happening with that in South America?
Well, actually, it's interesting. Both on the macro level, there is a movement inside South America to create a unified trade block, currency block, almost like the European Union, the Bank of the South, and all of the countries of South America are engaged in a conversation about creating a new currency to free themselves up from the dependence on the dollar or the euro. So at a macro, at a very top macro level, there's a real interest in South America in breaking out of the hold that the current international monetary system has on that part of the world. Basically, a debt hold that those countries are all indebted to a dollar-based lending system around the world run by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
And also a system that's based on consumption and continuous expanding growth.
Yeah, that gets into looking at what the characteristics of a money system are, and that's work that we're engaged with in Ecuador and in South America on a broader scale than just Ecuador, and we're starting to work on up here too. Yeah, what you mention is this issue. People don't notice that money is not a, it's not a commodity. It's a set of agreements, and in that set of agreements, there's behaviors that get created depending upon the agreements that are built into this medium of exchange that we've created. And so our money system, and almost every money system in the world, is lent into existence. To get money to spend, it's lent into existence, either by the government borrowing it and spending it, or by us private citizens borrowing it from our banks. And it's always lent with interest on it. So you have a system where any money that's circulating actually over time owes back more money than is in circulation. It's like a big game of musical chairs.
This is like what David Corton calls the phantom wealth, how we create the phantom wealth.
Right. Yeah, David Corton has written a lot about this, some really insightful, useful stuff. But basically, we've got a system where the money system has built into its agreements, the way it's constructed, an imperative to grow. If we don't grow, we collapse because you run out of the ability to pay back the debts. So you've got to continue to make more loans to loan the interest that it takes to pay back the debts. It creates an imperative for economic growth. That imperative for economic growth creates an imperative to convert the natural world to money to pay off loans. And it creates a situation where you've got, where you've built into the human exchange system with each other a imperative for competition. Everyone's competing. There's not enough money to pay back all the loans. Everyone's fighting to get the money they can to pay back their loans, and everyone is everyone else's enemy then, to a certain extent in that game.
It's kind of like a huge Ponzi scheme that uses the natural resources and environmental gifts that we have to keep funding something that keeps growing like a seven-headed hydra, you know.
Right. Yeah, the system can keep growing as long as we keep issuing more money into existence. But at some point, money to be useful is a medium of exchange. When you put money into existence, it's got to facilitate production being purchased by consumers who need to buy that consumption. And consumers who need to buy, they also have to have something they produce that goes into the system. So money to go into existence needs to match production with consumption. If the interest rate we have in our money system is causing more money to go in than we have production and consumption to match it, we either get massive inflation, or at some point when the money gets disconnected with the basic underlying economy, we get these huge bubbles like we've just had, which eventually burst and collapse.
Certainly, anyway, feeds the myth of separation.
Yeah.
And of, you know, I've got mine and you might get yours, but somebody's going to lose out on that. The
unexamined
beliefs and assumptions we've talked about before.
Yep. So anyway, what we're doing in Ecuador right now, Ecuador got rid of its own currency in the year 2000. It uses the dollar. So in a situation where there's a shortage of dollars in the United States, which there are now, a shortage of money to keep our economy running, in Ecuador it's even exacerbated, it's even more, because they don't have the ability to print dollars. So what Ecuador is starting to feel, an economic slowdown. There's just as many entrepreneurs in Ecuador, though, as there were 2 years ago. There's just as many people who have production, their handicrafts, their food that they want to sell, and there's just as many people who want to buy them. But the medium of exchange has dried up.
Mm.
And the only way they can get the medium of exchange that they think they need to use, which is a U.S. dollar, is to somehow borrow it or earn it from outside. They have to give away their resources to get those dollars, or they have to borrow it. And it's a fallacy to think that these producers and consumers can't get together and exchange valuable services for each other because they don't have dollars. You can create a medium of exchange for them locally. And it doesn't need to be lent into existence with interest attached to it. And it can be created democratically by producers who want to consume something, and they can produce to earn back the money that they give to somebody when they consume. You can create money locally, democratically, without interest. Doesn't have the competition built into it, the sense of competition. Doesn't have the imperative for economic growth. And so that's what we're working on. This is not something new we've thought up. It's something that's been going on. It's been known in the world for hundreds of years. Certainly, people have studied our money system. It was a big issue of contention when the United States was founded, how the money should be created. And it's been an argument that's gone back and forth and got decided sort of decisively on the side of private corporations will issue the money for our country. That got decided in 1913 when the Federal Reserve was created.
Exactly.
But it's still in the Depression, when the Depression of the 30s came along, alternative money systems grew up all over the United States.
I'm just wondering, with this move to being more involved in the community, I'm reminded of, have you been to Damanhur in Italy?
Sure.
You know, they have their own little currency, the Damanhurian there.
Right.
And it's a very closed system based on what they produce. And I'm just wondering if that isn't something that might begin to pop up in our communities as some mediums of exchange for local communities. Do you foresee anything like that happening?
Well, I think that's happening. I think that's happening already. There's lots of local currency movements, and they're useful in that they do keep the medium of exchange circulating inside the community. Mm-hmm. So I think there already are lots of local community movements, alternative currency movements, complementary currency movements that are starting to grow just because of the economic crisis. What we're trying to do, I think, is another step above that, though, because what we're trying to do in Ecuador, what we're working on, our vision in Ecuador is to create a national alternative currency system that is not just local. It's used locally, but it's linked together nationally. And the main focus of it is that money is not lent into existence with interest attached to it, that it's democratically issued by consumers who want to buy and have the ability to produce also to earn back the money they've issued, so that it doesn't have this imperative to growth, but that it does facilitate national exchange.
That's what I was wondering about. Yeah.
That communities then can exchange using this currency. Mm-hmm. And as long as it's structured properly, you can structure it so that it's not inflationary, doesn't take wealth from local communities and take it to other communities. And if we structure it properly, I think we can structure it in a way that it will grow and allow the same kind of currency to be used for exchange between Ecuador and other countries. There's actually a very exciting project going on in Uruguay right now to create a national currency. They're not calling it a currency. They're calling it a stimulus for microcredit and development, community development. But it, in its essence, is an additional money system that doesn't have interest attached to it, having it lent into existence. It sort of breaks the power of old money that our current money system has. Whoever essentially has the money that can lend it into existence then is constantly raking money out of the economy over into their side of the house.
Like a casino.
Yeah, like a big casino. Except in this casino, I think there have been several estimates done I'd seen recently where the amount of the interest component of the economy, if you look at all the trades and the amount of interest that has to be handled by all the economic activity, the cost of goods and services is made up nearly 50% by interest.
Oh, my God. Really?
Yeah. This was a study. I saw a study done in Germany and another study from this group that's doing the work in Uruguay. And what happens is that interest is earned by a very small part of our society. 1%, 2% earns a huge amount of that, and the rest of the society pays it. So that was the other thing I wanted to say about our current money system. It's basically a huge inequality-producing
mm-hmm.
system.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do in Ecuador, because Ecuador doesn't have its own money system now, it doesn't have a banking system that has a huge vested interest in being able to create money for the government, our theory is there won't be as much resistance to putting in place a national money system. So we're working on several levels, both on a business-to-business level, at a very local level with community credit cooperatives, and then this initiative where we're trying to tie in with what is being done in Uruguay. I think this issue, the money issue, is an issue that needs to be addressed again in our society, in the United States, needs to be addressed in the Western developed world. The retaining of value for money and the financial system took precedence over the well-being of our communities.
Yes.
I mean, it's amazing when you look at, as soon as the banks got in trouble, we were able to create trillions of dollars. But we can't fund the Millennium Development Goals to alleviate poverty in the world. There's just something crazy there. I mean, the point is we obviously can fund the poverty alleviation of the Millennium Development Goals. We can obviously fund what we need to build sustainable economy, to get off a fossil fuel economy, to get to a renewable economy. We can obviously fund that, as shown by that we can create trillions of dollars out of nothing. Now, we're doing it because we're trying to prop up a money system. But if we made a commitment to that, what the highest priority is moving our society to a sustainable, just, fulfilling society, we can create the money to do that just by saying that's our highest priority. And as long as we're creating money and putting it in place to support production and to support growth of human activity and human well-being, there's never a shortage of money to do that. We can obviously do that. But it may mean undermining the old money system. There'll be a resistance to that, but
well,
we clearly
like
need
we're
to do
doing
it.
That. Unconsciously in some ways with the way we're printing more and more money, with the direction that we're going, it really feels like we're going to have to come to a crisis. I mean, where are these trillions and trillions of dollars going to come from? At some point, we're either going to have hyperinflation or what? How do you see that? I mean, what do you think about what's going on in that area?
Well, I mean, let's see. It looks like we're not addressing it. All of our solutions are solutions that are trying to keep the money system in place, the one we have. At least everything I see makes me think that that's all we're doing. I haven't heard, I hope, that somewhere in the bowels of the Obama finance administration, somewhere in those you know, the wonderful, the great brains that are working on our financial issues, that there's somebody saying, no, look, here's what we ought to do. We ought to start issuing money directly ourselves as a nation rather than borrowing it from private banks. That's the craziest thing ever that we do. It's so crazy that people can't even get their head around it, what actually we do. We use the full faith and credit of our nation to give a franchise to banks to be able to lend money back to the United States government. We pay interest to these guys we gave the franchise to. We could cut that out. That's what Lincoln did with issuing the greenbacks mm-hmm. to fund the Civil War. That's what we need to be doing now, is looking at how do we, let's create the money and let the government spend it into existence for programs that are clearly aimed at improving human well-being, health care, poverty reduction, moving to a sustainable, a green economy. That's what we need to do. I saw somebody also say what we ought to do is let's just create money and buy back all the debt. And
is that what monetizing?
Well,
the debt
right
or?
Now we're paying interest on all this debt.
Mm-hmm.
So just create money and buy the debt back.
Oh.
And cancel the debt. Now there's a whole bunch of money out there, but the money wouldn't be any more inflationary than what we've got now, where we've got to pay back these loans plus interest, although most loans get rolled over rather than paid back. But if the money's out there, then we could use the money for health care, for education, for environmental sustainability. There's just a fundamental shift that needs to take place in the way our money is created in this country and in the developed world. That's what we're working on in Ecuador. We're not just trying to solve this in Ecuador, other than Ecuador is a perfect petri dish to do an experiment because they don't have their own currency anymore and they're suffering real economic deflation, depression. And they've got a progressive government, so there's a chance of putting a money system in place there that then can be a model. The ultimate goal is to change the money system of the
global money system.
The global money system, yeah. Which is this debt-based domination system that creates competition, inequality, and destroys the natural environment.
One of the things that's amazing to me is when you look at unemployment, because it's very much, of course, related to the money system, you know, there are more than enough jobs that need to be done if we were thinking of rather the auto industry, the transportation industry, if we were thinking of the need to clean up the environment, to leave it 6-7 generations out. All of these things, every man, woman, and child, they would have full-time employment. But because of our money system, that's not happening, and our belief system that's holding it into place. Do you think that South America is going to become a kind of beacon of light for the rest of the world with these new things popping up, or possibly?
Well, let's see. I think there's work being done in South America looking at those issues in a creative way. Just as you point out, that you've got human beings that want to work. They're creative. Entrepreneurial. There's other people who need to buy things to support their living, style of living, or to support their businesses, their production, and they can't do it because they don't have the money. It's nuts. That issue is being addressed in South America now in many cases. I think it's also being looked at, though, all around the world. I think it's being looked at, starting to be looked at here in the United States. It's being looked at in Europe.
What about China and India? I mean, that's one of our wild cards that could...
Yeah, well,
everything
one, it,
could
well it's interesting.
Apart.
One of the things China does, China doesn't borrow its money from a private banking system. China issues its own money. So any interest that's paid on that money, if it is issued with interest, stays in the state coffers and can be used for development issues within the agenda of the state or can reduce whatever levies and taxes need to be imposed on the people to pay for the government. I'm not sure what India's... India probably does it the way the British system has done it, where money is lent into existence from private banking system. Yesterday on Michael Krasny had on his show, on Forum, he had a discussion with... can't remember the name of the guy, but it was a guy who's talking about our money system and our economy and the corporatism of our life and how we're stuck in this economic system that we think is more important than life is. We think life is about supporting the economy rather than economy about supporting life. So I'm hopeful that there's more and more discussion going on now where people are waking up to that money is not a fixed object that's just a given. It's not. It's something that has facets to it that are human created, and we can change those facets. And as we change those facets, we create different interactions amongst ourselves as humans. We create different society, and we can create a society that's much more democratic, much more equal, just by changing the way we put money into circulation and how it's used as a medium of exchange. And I think that's something that I'm working on, because I'm working on it in South America, and we're starting to look at how we work on it here in the U.S. too, through the Pachamama Alliance. And this organization we're working with in South America had a vision of calling a big conference in the United States, getting 20 cities that are really faced by depression. So Detroit, mm-hmm. Cleveland, Oakland is having huge problems. 20 major cities, enrolling somebody from senior person from government, a local banker, and somebody from the Chamber of Commerce. You get three people from each of those cities at a major conference and show them how to create a means of supporting economic development. So that's basically it.
That's really exciting. Yeah. How can people support it?
Well, right now, this is something that's just come up in the last couple of weeks from our work in Ecuador with this organization called STRO, which is a Dutch NGO that works on community development issues around the world. We've been talking with them about doing that, and we're starting to do the work. We've told them we'll start to investigate and see if we can find the 20 cities. Pachamama Alliance here in the U.S. will start to do work to see if we can enroll 20 cities with their support and then look at putting together a conference probably the beginning of next year to see if we can develop a means of creating on a national basis a supplementary method of exchange that allows depressed areas to get out of their depression and foster entrepreneurship again.
Wow. Great project.
Yeah.
Any last word you can speak to the individual about what this means to them or how they can become more involved and take a part in this?
One of the first things that comes up is I just want people to really open their minds to and open their willingness to understand the money system and to at least just recognize that most of us don't have a clue what money is. And we think we do, and when people talk, when you hear people talking about the money system could be redesigned, I would encourage people to be really open to that conversation and really dig into it and look at it. I think it's one of the most fundamental and important things we could do as a human society is to change the system of money that we have, that it's probably the most transformational action that we could take, more transformational than meditation and eating great organic food, just this basic dirty thing of money. Changing the way that's created, put into existence could be one of the most transformational things and an essential step, I think, to building a sustainable world. So I would just encourage people to open themselves up to that and be open to that idea.
Bill Twiss, thank you so much for being on our show, but also for your tireless work and your commitment to bringing a planet forward that works for all life. It's just a pleasure to be with you again. And
thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
And you've been listening to Conversations with Michael Stone on KVMR FM, Nevada City, California, Music of the World, Voice of the Community.